Welcome back to Ontario Today. I'm Rita Celli. That is A Million Whys. It's a piece by our guest, Jason Brown. He is a math wizard, a lover of fractions and logarithms. The Beatles, I think you can hear some of that influence there, and solving the mysteries of life with math, especially music. Jason Brown is a math professor at Dalhousie University, and he's teaching other math profs in Ottawa this week. Foot soldiers, you could say, in the battle to turn the world onto math. So you can give us a call, too, if it's something that makes your toes curl or if it makes you queasy. You can join the conversation. How is it that those itty-bitty numbers get right under your skin or light up your world? 1-888-817-8995. Jason Brown, what were you trying to do when you put together this piece, A Million Whys?
Well, I had studied the Beatles' songs for a long time, and I was in a place where I was looking for mathematical principles in their work and in the work of the best songs. And then I decided to write a song, a rock song, using those principles. And it's not meant to be a knockoff of one of their songs. It's meant to be a new song in the genre where, like the Beatles, I tried to place as many mathematical tricks in the songwriting as I could.
Oh, really?
And I took principles that I learned from their works and others and extended it. And then I wanted to put together the whole song and have it sit as a good song. I want it to be a song that people would appreciate whether they could see the math in it or not.
Interesting. This is actually on a new CD or
yes,
first CD?
First CD.
Songs in the Key of Pi.
That's right.
Okay, let's take another caller. Joseph's on the line in Toronto. Hi, Joseph.
Hi.
Hello. So where's this bringing your brain today?
Well, this is an issue that's been with me all my life. I'm in my 50s. One of my fascinations is the fact that music is very, very close to me. My mother used to play when I was in the womb. It calmed me down when I was in the womb. And when I was a child, I grew up with a classical record collection, listening to the radio. And the first time I ever played piano, I actually played a little song without ever having had lessons before. My parents were blown away and bought a piano for me. Problem is, I was never exposed to mathematics. And when I hit grade school, I was in the bottom of the class. So I always felt there was a connection there between mathematics and music, as I learned later in life that the kids I went to school with, the ones who were the best at mathematics and who pursued music, were the quickest to learn the theory, quickest mm-hmm. to learn notes, mm-hmm. and could sight read quickly and had no problem, no anxieties whatsoever with music.
Yeah.
But I never learned to properly sight read. I even went to the conservatory in Toronto, the Royal Conservatory, and I got my, I think, grade 7 or 8. I faked it all the way through.
Is that right?
I learned the notes note by note, and I mostly when I learned a song, for instance, I played Fur Elise for at one point, I learned it by listening to it. I faked out my music teacher by pretending I could read the notes on the page, but I couldn't. I just listened to what he was playing, mimicked it perfectly, and looked at approximations in the page where I thought the notes would be, and he thought I could read music. Hmm. So to me, I wonder, I love math, as a matter of fact, because I know what it is. To me, it's like a secret language, only I never got the Captain Midnight decoder ring to figure it out when I was a kid. And I would love to learn mathematics now. I'm in my 50s, and I still have this passion that one day, somehow, the seas will part and the magical truth will come out, and I will finally learn the secret of mathematics. So my question is there anything you suggest, Jason, I could do to try and learn mathematics, or is it so just forget it, maybe just stick with the ability I have?
I don't think you should forget it. You know, often I have heard this story often, and people who typically don't do well in mathematics or don't have an affinity for it, it's often traced to some poor teaching early on. I mean, if you have a bad teacher in English for 1 year, you can recover from that. But if you miss a concept in mathematics, you have one bad teacher in 1 year early on, you may never recover from it. And it's a shame. I think, you know, what you can do at this point is trying to incorporate tiny little bits of mathematics. And it may not even be mathematics. It may be a mathematical viewpoint. If you're a musician, you will probably have an affinity to patterns and hearing patterns in pieces and how they transformed. When Bach plays, you hear a song by Bach, you can hear the patterns being transformed in different ways.
Yeah.
And that's probably the thing that appeals to you. And, you know, a mathematical viewpoint would tell you, okay, I recognize the patterns. What about if I extend it? What about if I do something a little bit new? And sometimes what I do is I try to figure it out mentally first before I try to play it. Because the thing is that often we play things musically that are easy for us to play, things that we've played before. What you want to do is use the mathematics to push yourself beyond your boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you can add a little bit of math, a tiny little bit, you know, on an ongoing basis.
You don't like
basis.
The idea of someone like Joseph giving up.
No, yeah. No, you shouldn't give up. It's a shame because these people know that they're drawn to it. I will mention the story is very familiar because George Harrison did very poorly in mathematics going through. He never did well in school. And later on in life, he said he just couldn't get it. He just couldn't get it. He couldn't find the applications. And yet he would sit home in his later years when he was not doing much music, and he would watch on television, Open University had mathematics classes. Now, what person who doesn't do well in mathematics and doesn't understand mathematics would watch it on TV unless he felt subconsciously there's a connection there?
Yeah.
He would have, I'm certain, appreciated seeing, you know, the mathematics that's in his playing because I see a lot of it.
Interesting. Joseph, thanks for your call as well. Let's go next to Keith. Keith, where are you calling us from?
I'm on Wasega Beach right now. I'm just passing through.
Okay.
And was listening to your conversation and had to make the phone call.
Tell us why.
I took the requisite math courses all the way through grade 13 when I was in school, and then promptly for the rest of my life essentially used math to make change, and that was about it. And then this winter I took a course in ship stability. I'm a ship's captain.
Wow.
And I now have a love affair with mathematics. It was just amazing. For example, in algebra, if I have 400 tons to be spread out over two loads, and I go 400 and then 400 minus X for the second hold, and I relearn trigonometry, and I would come home every night and blather on about all the nice and neat stuff that I learned, that there is a real-life application for this.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, there's an application, but on the other hand, what you are experiencing is the beauty of the mathematics.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
And I think a lot of people miss the beauty, but it's what attracts all mathematicians.
Well, what's beautiful, but how do you articulate it?
How do you articulate? When things fall into place, when everything makes sense, you know, when I do mathematics and after months, I find a proof of something, or I found what's called a counterexample, the opposite of a proof. I found an example that I've been hunting for, like a needle in a haystack. It's as if the skies open up and a light shines down on me and hits me. And it's an experience that's wonderful to have. It's everything makes sense.
Is it kind of like I might react to a tightly reasoned argument when I read a court document, like from a judge?
Right, well,
it's really ordered and it makes sense.
And I think that's why people like watching shows like CSI. It's the deductions when everything begins to fall into place and everything makes sense. Everyone loves that.
Okay. Keith, thank you for your call as well. I'm glad you pulled over to give us a call. We're going next to Jim in Ottawa. Jim, we're talking about, well, I guess depending, mind-blowing math or miserable math for you?
A little bit of both. I think I was just listening to the previous discussion there, and I think the word that I love to use in math is elegant. And I credit my grade 9 math teacher, who's Mr. Pinneger from Canterbury High School. If you're listening, thank you, because he was fascinated with the elegance of a solution. Back to the topic of math and music, I've been a musician for most of my life as a classical guitar player. And I remember very early on learning the phenomenon of the circle of fifths. Are mm-hmm. you familiar with that?
Yes.
Can you describe it for our audience?
Ratios like a fifth and a fourth and an octave are what are called perfect ratios in music. And it's where if it's perfectly tuned, you play the two notes on the piano or the guitar or whatever, two pieces playing together, and you will hear, it will sound as one and there'll be overtones generated. The ratio between an octave, most people will know, is from the frequency, is a 1 to 2. The ratio from a fifth is a 3 to 4. And if you go up in the circle of fifths with that ratio, starting with, say, a concert pitch of A440, and you go the ratio all the way back until you're supposed to get back to the A, the original A, at the, in an octave ratio, it will be out of tune.
Hmm.
And this is, you talk to piano players and musician history or historians about the well-tempered clavier, the Bach pieces that he wrote in the 17th century. It was, pianos were not tuned all the same, depending on the key that you were playing with. And they didn't know how to handle the various keys with the tuning. A piano was actually slightly out of tune for everything. Mm. And it was just that pure elegance of seeing how the math worked, but seeing how aesthetically it hits your ears. An octave, a perfect octave, you can't almost hear the two notes. A fifth sounds really rich and deep, a fourth a little bit different, and so forth. But to know that it's mathematical, but not mathematical.
It's interesting.
It doesn't end up where it starts if you follow the same ratios.
Yeah, Jim, I mean, you are articulating a lot of this quite beautifully, actually. Your thoughts, Jason Brown?
Well, I mean, the whole history of scales that we play in music, as Jim said, the ratio for perfect fifth, on which a lot of music is based, is 3/2. And if you keep repeating a perfect fifth, you'll find out that you never get back essentially to the same note that you started with or in an octave of it. So, and that was a big problem because then you couldn't change keys. And musicians want to change keys. It's the way you give variety. So what they had to do was the way out of this musical problem was a mathematical solution, that they decided to not have a perfect fifth be 3/2 as a ratio, but it was they used the 12th root of 2, which is an irrational number. It sounds irrational, but it solves the problem that we don't hear the perfect musical sounds anymore. We give up on that for an approximation that allows us to do more.
Our guest is Jason Brown. His book is called Our Days Are Numbered, How Mathematics Orders Our Lives. I want to just ask you really quickly, if I can, because in the book, you go in a lot of different directions.
Right.
Can you explain how you worked in a conversation from Seinfeld between Jerry and George about girls in your book?
Well, the question there was... you know, I was talking about how to make the best choice. If you have a bunch of alternatives that are going to come up to you, and you can rank them, so one is better than the other, so you could, but you don't know the order that they're coming in, how do you decide which one to pick? So I use this as an analogy of George deciding how he's going to choose the woman that he's going to marry, because he's getting a whole bunch of offers. Say he has 20 offers that are going to come by, and if he lets someone pass who was the best one, well, that wouldn't be a good idea. So how's he supposed to know? Well, the mathematics said you should let roughly about 37% of them go by and then choose the next one that's better than all the previous ones and marry her.
Okay, and then you give like the scenario of like the husband and wife arguing about when to take a vacation, like coupled them need not battle or something like
battle
that?
Battle them. You know, how we
same
make...
Same idea?
Well, it's a similar idea. These are talking about what's called game theory, which is how you play games against one another. And it might not sound like a game, but when you've got competing interests and you try to come to the mutually best solution or sometimes the best solution for yourself, that falls into the realm of game theory. So I talk about in the book how to go about making decisions rationally rather than from the seat of your pants.
And can we really do that? I mean, the scenario was Cleveland versus Europe. Frankly, I know how I would have voted. I don't need a graph, but if I was was negotiating maybe with someone.
In real life, I would go with my wife.
Maybe she would have picked you up too. But do you apply it this way in your own life? Like, do you,
well,
you make the little
sometimes,
graphs?
Sometimes, and, I don't always do that.
Honey, this is the value of...
That doesn't always go over well.
I can well imagine.
No, not all the time. But it gives you a sort of a framework to use sometimes when you're stuck and you want to find a more rational way to do things.
All right. Yes. Okay. That's actually a good answer, that when you're stuck and you need the rational, not the emotional, because most of our decisions are emotion-based in the end.
Right. And then really sometimes are. Not the best decisions.
Okay. Let's take another caller. Vivian's calling us. Vivian, where are you calling us from?
I'm calling from Toronto.
Okay. So?
And I want to go back to the music idea.
Go ahead.
But... from the opposite point of view, your guest said that knowing math helps with, that everybody knows a little bit of math, which helps musically. I grew up with exactly the opposite position. In Wales, where I went to high school, when we got past our third year and started to do the last 2 years of our five-year high school course, we had to choose an art or a science course. And with art, we had to take one math, and with math, one art. So I chose art, and instead of the mathematics, which it was suggested to everybody that they take, and which most people did, I said, no, I couldn't bear to take math. I'd like to take I would like to take geography or whatever it was. So they all thought about it, and the teachers got back to me and said, all right, we'll let you drop mathematics provided you make music a major subject instead of a minor.
Oh, okay.
And that's exactly what I did. And I found after I grew up that they'd been very wise, that I was able to understand math from having had to write music when I was 14, 15 years old.
Let's hear from our guest, Jason Brown. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I'm disappointed that they kind of made you choose between math and art, because they are so closely related. It's like saying to someone, use your right brain or your left brain.
That happens a lot, though. I think her story, I think a lot of people would believe that, would relate to what Vivian's saying in some way.
Right. Well, I think people think math is all left brain, all analytical, and they think that arts are all right brain, emotional. And yet both actually incorporate both sides of the brain. They found out with music that different areas of the brain lights up, and it's not just the right side. It's distributed all over the brain, and it's the same with mathematics. So, you know, trying to pull apart mathematics and the arts, it does both a disservice.
So, I mean, when you're going to be talking about professors, for example, is the idea to try to pass along some of this in terms of translating into the classroom?
Oh, definitely.
Their own teaching?
Oh, definitely. Students, especially the non-math majors, should find out that mathematics is interesting. Mathematics can help them be more creative. At Dalhousie, I've given a talk on the creative process, where most of the people speaking were people from the arts. And I want to emphasize to them that mathematics is a creative endeavor. It can bring something just for you, just to the arts, if that's all you want it to do.
But and it's creative even though, see, I think people, there's a mythology around it, I guess, because there's a formula to figure it out. But you're saying it's creative.
It is creative. You know, people think mathematics just involves formulas. I had a professor when I went to university as an undergraduate who told me he went to mathematics because he had a bad memory. Because in mathematics, unlike really any other field, there's so little you have to memorize. You deduce most things. You remember just a little bit. So the idea that mathematics is formulas, it's like saying to someone in English, oh, you went into English because you like punctuation.
Okay, let's take another caller. Brian, where are you calling us from?
Oh, I'm calling from, near Lost Channel on the Pickerel River.
Oh, okay. So are you a lover of
math? I'm really secretly from Toronto, but I'm up here because I'm retired and I can go to the near north and it's beautiful.
So tell us, I mean, are you a math lover or does it make your skin crawl?
I used to teach math and science about 40 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And I was going to tell you about the Möbius strip and how art, physical, beautiful art can be made from the Möbius strip. But I'll just tell you one little brief thing about 40 years ago, I used to teach science math, and we used to have an oscilloscope, and I had a really amazing flautist, and she could blow a perfect sinusoid and then change her embouchure a bit and get the second intonation coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the really good flautists can control the overtones. Now, I don't know if that's ever come across you before.
Well, I haven't studied that to that extent, but I mean, every timbre that we listen to is this really the same overtones, but at different volumes.
I know, and some really good people can control the second overtone, which is all sines and trigonometry, which you mentioned earlier. Anyway, the Möbius strip. Somebody sent me a website, and you can apparently cut. And I tried a bagel. You have to have a fairly large hold bagel,
mm-hmm.
and you can cut it with a Möbius strip cut. Okay. You probably can find it by Googling bagels and Möbius strip. And they had a nice picture of it. And if you do a double twist, a 360 twist, not the usual half twist, you can cut it beautifully and make, and it ends up cutting it in half, but they're interlocking rings. Isn't that freaky?
I keep trying to visualize this.
I know. And people have actually made sculptures of this, like, huge things.
Have you tried it?
Tried it with a bagel, and it almost worked. So then I made a styrofoam bagel, and it worked.
Sudoku?
You can do it with a donut, but it gets really gucky and messy. I tried it.
Yeah, Jason Brown, have you ever heard of this?
Well, just go to Google Möbius, and I forget the name, and he actually has a picture, and he drew on it with magic marker. He's some math professor in the state somewhere.
Okay.
He drew on the picture or the bagel?
He drew a picture on the bagel of how to cut it, and then he cut it.
Yeah.
I'll go to the website. It's like step by step.
Okay, where everyone is going to be Googling away. So
it's going to be an overload on the cutting a bagel. Apparently, you can get about 10 or 11% more surface area for spreading cream cheese, you see.
It's an application.
Very nice. Well, I mean, you've never tried this, obviously.
No, but I've. Everyone can try a Möbius strip. You just take a long strip of paper, take the two ends, and when you attach it, twist one over,
mm-hmm.
and then tape it. And what you'll do if you trace a line on one side and keep moving, you get back to where you start. So it really is an object that has one side to it.
Ah, I see. Okay. Let's take another caller. Matthew's joining us in Toronto. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how you doing?
We're doing fine. Hi. Playing with numbers today.
Well, you know what? When you started talking about this, and I go back to the mystery chord that you had for the Hard Day's Night, and it just got me thinking, made me bring on my guitar and look at my books. That's not a mystery chord. I have this amazing book. It's a G suspended with a D underneath it. All it is a broken G chord with a C added to it. And it's a beautiful chord.
Now, how do you know that's the right chord?
Well, because it sounds right. I picked up my guitar and I played it and it sounded good. Now, Jason, I understand you're a guitar player.
I am a guitar player.
Yeah, well, then you would know it. Just do it. Just play.
What note do you have on the bottom there? What bottom note are you playing?
Well, for this chord, I just play the bottom four strings on my guitar.
So you're fretting a G on the bottom?
So it's a D, G, C, G.
D, G, C, G. Yeah, I mean, you are hearing some of the notes that are in the chord, but that doesn't make up the chord. And actually, what George Harrison played on the bottom was the A string. He played actually mostly open strings.
He plays the A. Okay.
He plays A, D, G, and a C.
The only fingering I did was a G on the E string and the C on the B string, and then the whole guitar open. It kind of sounded cool.
So, yeah. But what Jason has said is that there is a piano in there. Can you hear?
Oh, no, it doesn't work in the piano. It's a guitar chord. Come on.
Well, even the producer said it was a guitar chord, but of course he plays piano on the chord.
Well, you know what? Just for fun, let's if we have it handy, let's just play it. I guess we don't have it handy. That's all right. I thought, you know, but that demonstrates in a way Matthew's call is that debate. I mean,
well,
you think
debate.
You've solved it, but Beatles haven't said for sure. You're confident in the math.
Right. I'm confident in the math.
I love the math.
You know, the thing is that it's almost like a paradox that you, on one hand, everyone believes that what they hear is the truth.
Mm.
And we have to get away from that. Just like we can't believe our eyes all the time, we can't believe our ears all the time.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, we have something actually that we were going to end the program with, but I think you should tell the audience about it. It's Little Richard's Long Tall Sally.
Well, the story here is that this is a research question, a math research question posed by that great mathematician Paul McCartney. So back in the 60s, he and John were trying to write a song as good as the best rock song that they knew. And the best rock song that they knew was Long Tall Sally. And so what it brought to mind for me is, why is Long Tall Sally such a great song? And I think it is a great rock song. It's very simple, but it has so much energy, and it's really very thrilling. And that took me even to the bigger question, because it is a blues, and a blues is a certain chord progression, why are the blues so great? Why do people devote their entire lives to listening to the blues? Why do people devote their entire lives to playing the blues when it's the same 12 bars over and over again, the same chord sequence?
Yeah.
And so what I did was find a mathematical reason for why the blues are so thrilling, why it is the unique set of chords, sequence of chords, that we would find as thrilling as a roller coaster ride.
There it is.
There it is.
Well, Jason Brown, lots of ground we actually didn't cover, even though there was that nefarious plot to devote our show to math.
Now, I want to invite people to the public lecture tomorrow.
In Ottawa?
In Ottawa at Carleton University. It's in the Azrieli Theater, room 101, 11 to 12. So play hooky from whatever you're doing. It'll be one chance to play hooky and say you went to math lecture. And it'll be a lot of fun. I'll have a live band with me, and you'll hear about these
You're
things.
Also signing books, I think, at Chapters this afternoon in
at
Ottawa.
At Chapters at 2:30.
All right.
On Rideau.
Our guest, thanks for coming in. Jason Brown, math professor at Dalhousie University's book is called Our Days Are Numbered, How Mathematics Orders Our Lives. Tomorrow, George Rodriguez, the renovator guy, is in. Also looking at the anniversary of Walkerton. We're leaving you with Little Richard. Woo!